funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Does your body hurt often? By some estimates, as many as one in five adults regularly experiences pain, and in some cases they suffer long after any obvious injury appears to have healed, or even in the absence of any such injury. Chronic pain can take a toll not only on our ability to feel good and get things done, but also on our moods, our relationships, even our mental acuity. Joining us to talk about the latest research into the causes of chronic pain and how sufferers might find relief, we have two associate professors from the neuroscience faculty at the University of Texas at Dallas School of Behavioral and Brain Sciences. Ted Price specializes in the molecular biology of pain. Greg Dussor specializes in the physiology of pain. Welcome, both of you, to Think.
Thank you. Thanks. Pleasure to be here.
I have to say I was surprised to learn how many adults cope with chronic pain, 15 to 20%. What falls under that umbrella?
Well, there are many kinds of pain. There's many kinds of chronic pain. The most common form of chronic pain is low back pain. That's followed by osteoarthritis. And then we have migraine headache, which, of course, is another very common form of chronic pain. Many people suffer from acute pain also, which is also very important to treat. It's very important to treat because I think what we've learned from the last 25 years of research into mechanisms of pain is that acute pain can often be a cause of chronic pain. So adequately treating acute pain is very important, and if not adequately treated, can lead to the development of chronic pain. Of course, many chronic pain disorders, we don't understand very well what causes them to originate, and that's a really active area of research. And if we understood that better, we would likely be able to treat these conditions better.
So chronic pain and acute pain might feel the same, but chronic pain is something that lasts for a particular duration of time or recurs over time?
6 months is usually the cutoff. Mm-hmm. Some people put it at 3 months, but 6 months is usually the cutoff for where you transition from an acute pain patient to a chronic pain patient.
What's going on in the brain when we feel pain under normal circumstances?
Well, under normal circumstances, pain is a teaching signal. It tells you that something is wrong and that you need to do something about it. So if you have, let's say, just sprained your ankle playing basketball or something like that, the pain that you have from that ankle sprain is telling you to stay off of your injured ankle, and there's a very good reason for that. Your tissue needs to heal. So initially, pain is telling you to avoid something that can cause long-term damage. It's telling you to stay off of an injury while the healing process goes on. And then eventually, hopefully, pain will resolve. Of course, the problem with many chronic pain patients and many chronic pain disorders is that after an initial injury resolves, you still have pain. So a really key area of current research is to try to understand why that happens. And I think what we've come to appreciate within the last probably two decades again, but work on the molecular biology of this is really starting to accelerate now, is that the nervous system changes in response to these acute painful events. And it's a lack of resolution of those changes in the nervous system that can cause pain to become chronic and to outlive that initial injury. We talked about definitions of chronic pain very briefly, and as Greg said, there's this it's very common for us right now to define chronic pain in terms of the duration of pain. But I think that many people in the field think that that is doing a disservice to what's actually happening in most of these patients, because we have now very good evidence that the brain is changing, circuitry within the spinal cord is changing, the peripheral nervous system is probably changing. And if we had mechanism-based markers for chronic pain, I think we would be in a much better place for several reasons. One, I think that it would greatly help us with education of patients to understand that there are changes that have occurred in the nervous system that are causing this to happen, and it's not all just in your head, for instance. It actually is in your head, of course, because the changes are in your brain, but they're very real changes. it also would allow us to get towards mechanism-based therapies, which in many cases we're not really at right now. And I think that we think based on current work that certain kinds of chronic pain should be targeted differently based on the mechanisms that underlie those forms of chronic pain.
So if I'm understanding correctly what you're saying, there are some cases in which someone experiences an injury, their nerves, and I'm going to use laypeople's terms here, get sort of hypersensitized to pain so that later on after the injury is healed, when an MRI or an X-ray looks completely normal, the nerve surrounding the initial injury sense pain even in conditions that ordinarily don't cause pain. Is that correct?
That's true.
Okay.
Yep. Now, you know, Ted spent a fair amount of time just now talking about a situation where you have an injury, the injury is healed, the nervous system may not have gone back to its original state, but the injury is gone, and the nervous system is still hypersensitive to things that it shouldn't be hypersensitive to, and that is certainly a big problem. What is also a big problem are conditions where there never was an injury. So, you know, we spend a lot of our time thinking about chronic pain conditions like migraine headache. There never was an injury in migraine patients. You can have a higher incidence of migraines following certain types of injury, particularly traumatic brain injury, but most migraine patients have not had a traumatic brain injury, at least one that we can identify. So their nervous system is different. It's changed. We don't know how that happened. And so it's very difficult for us to figure out how to turn it off because we don't know how it got that way in the first place. But it's all in the absence of an injury. So, you know, migraine is an extremely common chronic pain condition, and there never was anything that you can identify and easily point to in those patients that says, well, here it is. Here's what you did. Here's what happened to you. Here's why your migraines are happening. We just don't know.
I guess some chronic pain is unrelenting, but some of it comes and goes. Can we learn anything by looking at the times when, for reasons we don't yet understand, people are not experiencing pain?
Yes, absolutely. I think there could be a number of reasons for that. First of all, it seems to be the case that chronic pain can take a form which is unrelenting, or you have persistent, continuous pain. But then many people have chronic pain disorders where the pain is intermittent. And there's been a great deal of work showing that in those particular cases, what may be going on is that people have sub-threshold insults or very low-level inflammatory insults. So, you know, you may have a painful knee, for instance, and you may go for a walk and just turn slightly incorrectly and put a little bit of strain on one of the ligaments. Well, the nerves that innervate that knee are sensitized. They may not be active all the time, but they're sensitized. And that very small injury, which in a person who had never had any insults to that knee before would not cause any pain, can now cause a painful knee problem for 2 weeks, 3 weeks. That will also go away. The issue, though, is that plasticity is still there, that those changes in the nervous system are still there. And those are going to continue to drive these low-level insults causing a exacerbated pain state that wouldn't be present in somebody who didn't have those pre-existing problems.
Do we know why some people are more susceptible to chronic pain than others?
That's a tough question to answer. You know, we're looking on the genetic level. We're getting a lot better now at being able to analyze the entire genome of an individual and compare that genome to someone, maybe a relative who does not get chronic pain, and look for genetic changes. There's evidence that things that happen throughout your adolescence, maybe when you were very young, can influence the way that you perceive pain as an adult. So there could be a number of things that have happened to you in your history or are present in your genetics that are very difficult to turn around at this point, because genetics are very hard to change. And things that happened to you when you were 5 years old or 10 years old at some point during your adolescence, that was a long time ago, and it's hard to go back and fix that. So what we're interested in, what those changes are, and is there a way to turn them off?
Does that mean when you talk about what might have happened to us during childhood or adolescence, is that, you know, some kind of traumatic injury that left us with a fear of pain or hypersensitized our neurons? What do you mean?
Well, the fear of pain is certainly a big problem, and it's something that's talked about a lot in the pain research community. The simple fear of pain can be as debilitating as the actual pain itself. Just being afraid to do things that you think might cause you pain can prevent you from doing a lot of the things that we all enjoy doing on a daily basis. So there could have been some mild injury that you had as a child. May not even be enough that you remember it today, but enough to change your nervous system to set you up for a pain condition later. We just don't know what that is, and we don't know how extreme of an event it had to be. There could be early life stressors, your relationship with your family when you were younger can influence how you perceive and deal with pain as an adult. So there's a lot of things that can play into it. It's a very complicated disorder. That's part of the reason why we understand it so little. There's a lot of things that can influence pain. There's a lot of components to it, and it happens to be important. It is absolutely essential for the survival of any organism to be able to respond to things that are potentially damaging and get away from them. So as Ted mentioned earlier, it has a teaching component to it. And because that's so important for the survival of any species, there's a lot of mechanisms that contribute to it, and it's really hard to turn it off.
Help me understand nerve pain. There are people who have had spinal cord damage and have no normal sensation in particular limbs, but continue to feel pain long after the initial injury. What's going on there?
Yeah, so this is a remarkably difficult clinical problem to deal with. So nerve pain or neuropathic pain is defined as pain that originates from damage to either the peripheral or the central nervous system. It can take several different forms. One form is through traumatic injury. So the example that you just stated, spinal cord injury, is an example of a traumatic injury causing neuropathic pain. This can also happen in the periphery if you have a motor vehicle accident or something like that that would cause an injury to, say, the brachial plexus.
What is the brachial plexus?
Oh, so sorry, the nerves that are, it's the where the nerves are originating that are innervating your arm.
Okay.
So very common for people to have motorcycle accidents, for instance. It can happen as a result of stroke. So you can have central pain resulting from a stroke. It can also happen due to metabolic disease. So diabetes often causes a neuropathy. In fact, this is the most common form of neuropathic pain is diabetic neuropathic pain. It can also be caused by drugs that are used to treat diseases. So very unfortunately, many cancer chemotherapeutics cause neuropathic pain. And this can cause neuropathic pain that greatly outlives the duration of the therapy. So you have examples of people that survive breast cancer, colon cancer in men and women, respectively, and have tingling, numbness, and pain in usually their hands and their feet, which is very, very difficult because these are people that have survived a terrible disease and now have a decreased quality of life because they're living with pain. So there is a very large amount of work going into understanding mechanisms of neuropathic pain. And in fact, it's probably the most active area of research in the pain area. And I think that what we're starting to understand is that there are distinct pathologies that occur in the peripheral nervous system, and even in the case of central nervous system injury, which is really interesting. It appears to be the case that the brain is able to somehow communicate to the peripheral nervous system to make the peripheral nerves hyperactive after a central injury, like in the case of spinal cord injury. But there are also many changes that occur in the central nervous system. Some of these involve the major inhibitory neurotransmitter in the brain, which is called GABA.
Let me jump in here. Yeah. We have to take a quick break. We're speaking this hour with Ted Price and Greg Dusor, two researchers on the neuroscience faculty at UTD School of Behavioral and Brain Science. We'll talk more about chronic pain in a moment. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree with concentrations in human rights, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're talking about research into chronic pain with two experts in the field from the University of Texas at Dallas School of Behavioral and Brain Sciences. Greg Dusor specializes in the physiology of pain, and Ted Price specializes in the molecular biology of pain. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. And Ted, you were talking about some of the different ways that neuropathic pain can present itself, and I sort of cut you off midstream, so if you want to finish
up. Yeah, sure. So I was just starting to talk about GABA. So GABA is the major inhibitory neurotransmitter in the brain, and the brain depends on this excitatory neurotransmission and inhibitory neurotransmission to send signals from one place in the brain to another and to have an ultimate behavioral output. So researchers in Quebec about 10 years ago showed that after nerve injury in the spinal cord, there was a change in the inhibitory neurons, which utilize GABA, such that normal inhibition was transforming either into nothing, so it essentially had no effect, you were losing inhibition, or it could invert and become excitatory. So you can imagine if the spinal cord is kind of working as a gate, and that is actually the name of a very prominent theory in our field called the gate theory of pain. But the spinal cord acts something like a gate that modulates the amount of input that comes in from the peripheral nervous system on up to higher cortical centers that where you actually perceive pain. You don't perceive pain in the spinal cord. You do perceive pain in your cortex. So if the spinal cord is modulating the signals that are coming in and an injury to the peripheral nervous system increases the amount of signal that comes in, the job of the gate ostensibly should be to decrease that signal such that your cortex isn't overwhelmed with the signal that there's something bad happening to me, which is what a pain signal really is. So it turns out what's happening is you're losing this key protein, and I won't go into the molecular details of it, but and that causes GABA to lose its inhibitory action, or at least partially lose its inhibitory action, and it keeps this gate wide open. So you already have this problem going on where the peripheral nerves are firing when they either shouldn't be firing or they're firing because of the injury that has occurred, either through metabolic disease or some trauma. And this is now amplified because that inhibitory gate has turned itself off. So a major therapeutic target that has emerged from that is this idea that if you could turn that gate back on, that this could potentially turn off neuropathic pain in patients. So there's a lot of work ongoing in that area. Some targets were recently published, so these are molecules that haven't made it into humans yet, but are in some investigational trials, and we're, I think, all in the field very hopeful that this hypothesis, which has really permeated through the entire field now, will turn into something that can be fruitful and lead to relief for patients. Of course, neuropathic pain patients, only about 50% of them receive 50% relief from our best therapeutics. So these are patients really that suffer terribly from the disorder that they have, neuropathic pain, and for which we are unfortunately able to offer very few, if any, therapeutic treatments.
Many people are worried about the use of, say, narcotics to deal with chronic pain because of the addiction risk. Is there any way to mitigate that if that happens to work for people who are dealing with chronic pain?
Well, it turns out that in chronic pain patients, they may not actually respond to narcotics. And most of the time when we're talking about narcotics, we're talking about opiates, morphine, codeine, these kinds of things, OxyContin. The brains of chronic pain patients may not respond to drugs like opiates the same way that normal people do. So I am fortunate enough to not have chronic pain. If I were to take opiates repetitively, there might be an addiction potential there. In the brain of a chronic pain patient who is getting substantial relief from those opiates, their brains may not respond the same way to the rewarding properties of the opiate. It may not be as addictive to a chronic pain patient as it is to someone who doesn't have pain at all. And so, you know, it's easy for us to say we just need to be scared of opiates because we're creating a population of addicts in all these chronic pain patients. But it may actually not be true, or may not be entirely true, because their brains may just not find opiates as rewarding as the brains of people who don't have pain at all.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Milton in Fort Worth. Hi, Milton.
Hi there. I have a question regarding the way the medical community might look at individuals who have multi-sources of possible chronic pain, as example, an autoimmune disorder, physical back injuries that are chronic, multiple surgeries. In other words, somebody who has a potential for a number of reasons for having chronic pain and at time has pain from either one or all or some of the sources. Anyway, I was trying to get some sense of what that's looked at.
So that's an excellent question. You started the question by asking about how the medical community looks at this. And I think that raises a larger question, which is education about pain in the medical community. So there was an Institute of Medicine report. So this is a national institute. And they gave a report 3 years ago where they were outlining some of the problems in the pain field in terms of barriers to treatment, and looked specifically in part of the report at education, and found that medical doctors receive only about 2 hours on average of lecture in their first 2 years of medical school on pain.
Wait, are you serious?
I'm serious. So,
wow.
They receive so this is the number one thing that medical doctors are going to see in their practice, most of them, is people coming to them because of a complaint about pain. And we have very little education. In fact, the report demonstrated that medical doctors receive less education on pain than veterinary doctors, which is remarkable. We understand fairly well how the pain system works. We have a remarkable explosion in the basic science of pain and pain plasticity, which I think if we did a better job of educating medical practitioners on this, they would view the problem much differently than they currently do. So coming back to the original question, it's not uncommon to have people start to develop pain over their entire body or from multiple insults after they have chronic pain already from a single insult. And I think you know, if there's a theme of what we're saying here, it's that the brain changes after you develop chronic pain. And one way that I think we understand very well now that the brain changes is that we have these endogenous analgesic circuits. And most people know about this because it's what's responsible for the so-called runner's high. Right, and so we have a pretty good indication now from imaging studies that done in labs throughout the world that chronic pain patients eventually develop a deficit in this in these endogenous analgesic mechanisms, and that manifests in a couple of different ways. But one of them is that their brain is not engaging these endogenous opioid or endogenous cannabinoid systems that are supposed to dampen incoming pain signals. And that can lead to the exacerbation of pain with multiple insults. So I think that just having a little bit of understanding about that and educating patients about that in turn is really important to help people understand and for the medical profession to understand what's going on.
Do you think, I mean, are doctors judgmental of people who come to them with pain that they can't initially identify and understand?
You know, I'm a little hesitant to go that
far. Broad brush, but I mean, is that when we talk about not enough education, is that our concern?
I also hesitate to say that they're judgmental. I think, you know, many practitioners, and I should point out that neither one of us is a medical practitioner, although we have
PhDs in pharmacology.
PhDs in pharmacology, yes, in neuroscience. So, it's hard to answer that. I think that again, more education would be extremely helpful in this area, and we know enough now to help people make much better choices. A really good example of this is the American Pain Society, for instance, gives centers of excellence for pain treatment, and they do this routinely. Or the award is routinely given for institutes that take a multidisciplinary approach. And what I think that reflects is that what we understand now that treating a chronic pain patients, when we are limited with the pharmacological therapeutics that we can offer, requires a multidisciplinary approach, which can involve drugs, right? It involves physical therapy. It can involve psychological intervention and any number of other alternative medicines as well, right? So, and tailoring treatments that are appropriate for individual patients.
If I could just follow up, I think that back to the question of, are physicians judgmental? I think it's only natural as humans to, particularly in conditions where we can't actually see anything obviously wrong, to wonder, what's going on in this patient. If you come into a physician's office and there's clearly a herniated disc that you can see on a scan, your chances are much better of having everyone that you see believe you that there's something going on. It's particularly difficult for the types of pain where there never really was an injury. You can't put someone in a scanner and point directly to that thing that's causing the pain. And so that becomes a difficult situation because the physician has to trust the patient. For disorders like migraine, where it's so amazingly common, it's becoming an easier thing for physicians to get on board with. And that's been true for decades now. But I think today, conditions like fibromyalgia are where migraine was maybe 20, 30 years ago. There's nothing identifiable, nothing easily identifiable on a brain scan or a blood work, and yet these patients have repetitive episodes of pain. If they're lucky, maybe a couple times a year, but it can be many times a month if they're unlucky. And there's just nothing that you can point to. And so I think it's only natural to wonder, is there really something there? But I think as the scientific community gets better at really looking closely at what is different about patients who have migraine and fibromyalgia and actually finding things, because you can find changes in the brains of migraine patients and fibromyalgia patients that document that these are real conditions. As we get better at documenting those things, I think it'll be easier for the entire medical community to accept that these are real diseases.
What do doctors need to know about their patient's pain in order to find the therapies that might work best? In other words, how do we communicate about pain to the physicians that are caring for us?
Wow. That's a question I'm not sure that I can answer. So,
yeah, it's difficult. And chronic pain patients will know very well the list of medications that are given for chronic pain, because there is really no easy way to have a patient come in and just list exactly how they feel and exactly the type of pain that they have. Is it dull? Is it throbbing? Is it sharp? Is it electric-like? And have the physician say, oh, you clearly fit into this category. We're going to give you this particular drug. We're not there yet. There are certain categories of drugs that tend to work better for certain kinds of pain. There are drugs that work for inflammatory pain conditions that don't work for neuropathic pain conditions and vice versa. But there are many drugs within those two categories that may work well for one patient and not work well for another patient, and we just don't understand what the differences between those patients are. So we're not at that point yet where we can just look at someone and take a medical history and say, oh, clearly you need to be taking this drug. And so unfortunately, that means that you might have to take two or three or four drugs before you find the one that works on you. And we would love to get that time frame shorter so that we could hit on the first one and know that this one's going to work and get that patient relief quickly. We're just not there yet.
I think most people understand that pain can make it hard to sleep, right? Pain can make you irritable, and therefore it affects your relationships and maybe how you do at work. I was interested to read that it has been associated with cognitive decline if it persists for a very long time.
That's true. So a number of studies have shown that people with chronic low back pain or a really terrible chronic pain disorder called complex regional pain syndrome, which thankfully is relatively rare but more common than it should be, that those can cause decreases in cortical thickness, so the brain actually appears to be shrinking in certain areas. Luckily, a couple of studies have followed on to these initial works and looked at whether if these patients were treated adequately. In other words, if they had adequate pain relief, if their brains went back to normal, or if this was a permanent change. And it does appear to go back to normal, at least for chronic back pain patients, which is a remarkable finding, I think. And a number of investigators have looked also at a specific task called the Iowa gambling task in people that have chronic pain. It's basically a test of cognitive flexibility, and found that there's a major impairment in this kind of cognitive flexibility in people that have chronic pain. So yes, those effects are very real, and they have a big impact on quality of life for those patients.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have an email here from Paige who says, what comment might you have about pharmacogenetic testing, that is, using your gene map to determine which medications to take and which to avoid?
So that's a very important area of work. It has a number of different implications. One is, number one, everybody metabolizes drugs differently. So there could be people that metabolize certain analgesics very rapidly or don't metabolize them at all, and that makes them dangerous for that person to take, that individual to take. So there is a move for more individualized medicine based on your pharmacogenetic profile. I don't think this is something that's used widely right now, but the day is coming. Another part of that question is what Greg was talking about earlier, is that we are identifying more and more genes that appear to be involved in a susceptibility to develop a chronic pain disorder. And I think that those genes are telling us something about how we should think about treating these patients. We probably should not be treating them all in exactly the same way. And finding drugs that target those specific mechanisms could lead to a future where you see this kind of personalized medicine based on the genome of individual patients.
We're speaking this hour with Ted Price and Greg Dussor, both researchers in neuroscience at the University of Texas at Dallas School of Behavioral and Brain Sciences. We're talking about chronic pain research and relief. If you would like to join us, call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree with concentrations in human rights, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guests today are both associate professors on the neuroscience faculty at UTD's School of Behavioral and Brain Sciences. Greg Dussor specializes in the physiology of pain. Ted Price in the molecular biology of pain. We're talking this hour about research into chronic pain and relief of chronic pain. If you'd like to join us, call 1-800-933-5372. We have Mike on the line now in Garland. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Chris. I've heard reports of acupuncture being used in China to perform surgery without anesthesiology, and I wondered if your panelists would have any knowledge as to the basis of why acupuncture might be able to be used in pain relief as an alternative to opiates.
So that is also a very active area of investigation. So I guess this would fall under the guise of complementary and alternative medicines for pain. Acupuncture has been used for pain in Chinese medicine for centuries, millennia maybe. And I've not heard of it being used for surgery without anesthesia, but I'm very aware that many people do use it for the treatment of chronic pain or potentially minor acute pain. So A number of studies have looked at peripheral mechanisms of acupuncture. A number have looked at central mechanisms of acupuncture. And I think, and by central mechanisms, I mean the mechanisms of through which acupuncture might activate endogenous analgesic mechanisms in the brain. And it appears that acupuncture can do both. We don't understand precisely how that occurs at this point. Some trials that have been done in humans that have had what you would call appropriate placebo controls, insofar as you can do that with acupuncture, have shown limited efficacy of acupuncture, suggesting that maybe it's the anticipation of relief from the treatment that has an effect. Of course, what we know that anticipation of efficacy in any kind of treatment can have a powerful effect. That's the basis of the placebo effect.
Not necessarily a bad thing either.
No, nope. Absolutely.
It's a great thing.
Yeah. It's activating endogenous analgesic mechanisms in your brain. And it works in much the same way that taking an opioid works, which I think is really a remarkable concept. There's nothing wrong with that. And I think that this also is one of these things that if patients find things that are effective for them and that they're able to modify their life and reduce their disability burden based on chronic pain, then at the end of the day, it really doesn't matter what the mechanism is. They should utilize things that work for them.
Yeah, and to follow up on that, the placebo effect, particularly in pain, is extremely powerful. And we need to be better about trying to harness it. It appears as though when you go see a physician and they prescribe a medication for you, as important as you actually taking that medication is the message that the physician gives you when they prescribe the medication. If they prescribe it for you and say, well, this hasn't worked in any of my patients, and so we're just going to give it a shot, but I'm not really confident about it, the odds of that working, even if it's a powerful drug, are not going to be very good. But if the message is positive, you know, this has worked in every patient that I've given this to, I'm really confident that this is going to help you, I'm really excited, the chances that that's going to work are much better.
Yeah, and we were talking a little bit in the break about expectation. And, I think that Greg and I, working in this field, we envision a day when we could treat every chronic pain patient and alleviate most of their pain. But that's not the reality that we have today. And just a little bit of education in some respects can be very helpful to people because it, again, is doing basically the same thing. It's adjusting the expectation. So if a patient has a good understanding that, one, yes, their back has – or the major issue with their back has been healed, the injury is healed, but there's plasticity in the nervous system. There have been changes in the nervous system that are causing this pain to continue even though the injury is healed, and that there is no therapeutic that is going to reverse that currently, but there are physical therapy options, there's exercise options, there are mindfulness training and some therapeutics that can reverse this.
Yoga has been shown to have efficacy for pain, so yeah. Plenty of alternative therapies.
Sure, yeah. That can have a really big impact. Once people understand and adjust the expectation for how they can get on with their life.
Of course, there's not much you can do about this, but in cases of chronic pain that are linked to an initial injury, does the experience of like psychological trauma during that injury have any bearing on the likelihood that someone will experience chronic pain after they have ostensibly healed?
I think that is the case. That's not an area where I know the research very well. It seems very logical it should be the case. I can imagine scenarios where that could explain some of what happens, but I'm not. That's just not an area I'm really familiar with.
There's a big overlap between pain and depression, mm-hmm. and we talk about this all the time. It's a chicken or egg kind of scenario. Do patients become depressed because they have chronic pain, or are they more likely to have chronic pain because they have depression in the first place? So which came first, and we don't know the answer to that. But you can imagine that having pain on a daily basis is going to impact your mood. So it would not be surprising at all if the presence of chronic pain caused anxiety, depression, irritability, all kinds of things. You might also think that people who are depressed, who may be focusing on things that maybe are not productive or helpful, might focus on what might otherwise be an acute pain condition and turn it into something that actually is greater than it would be in a patient who was not depressed. So there's a lot of comorbidity between the two, and we just don't know which is coming first, but they can feed off of each other.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we have Jane on the line in Carrollton. Hi, Jane.
Hi. I have actually two questions. First of all, I'm wondering if there is anything available for pain patients at UTD, such as clinical trials. My second question is whether after a patient has been on opiates for a considerable time and they adapt to the opiates, is there hope of the body readjusting after a period of no opiates?
Okay, so to the first question, are there UTD does not have a school of medicine, and there could be clinical trials where we are collaborating with people. In fact, we currently are, but there are no clinical trials taking place at UTD. The second question is a fascinating one. So I think what she's talking about is tolerance and dependence. And so to just directly answer the question, yes. So receptors change when they're exposed to drug over a very long period of time. There are receptors in your body that respond to opiates that you take, and they can be desensitized so that they're less active when they encounter the drug over time. If you stop taking opioids, there can be some dependence issues, which can cause things like withdrawal or irritability, but eventually the receptors can go back to normal. One of the major manifestations of tolerance is that people that are taking opioids often have to take more and more opioids over time. That's because the receptors are less activated by the presence of drug than they were when you were opioid naive. And again, that can also be reversed. So the answer to the second question is yes.
How long would someone have to stay off opioids in order to experience that kind of rebound of sensitivity?
Well, that depends on the person. That depends on how long they had been on the opiate. That depends on the dose that they were taking. There's a lot of things that would factor into that, and it's really hard to make a statement on that without, you know, seeing the details of any given patient. But months,
okay.
Probably months. Somewhat related to this is there are conditions where the drugs that we use to treat pain over time can actually make pain worse. So, you know, we talk about this a lot in the migraine community. One of the gold standards for the treatment of migraine is a drug called sumatriptan, which is marketed under the name of Imitrex, one of the most common drugs given for migraine. In some patients who take these drugs repetitively, the headaches actually get worse and they get more frequent. And it's a condition that is now called medication overuse headache. So the nervous system is actually adapting to the presence of the drug and adapting in a counterproductive way because the headaches are getting worse, they're getting more frequent. And essentially what needs to happen with that patient is they need to stop taking the drug. The headaches will go back to their original intensity and frequency eventually, 6 months, maybe somewhat shorter, somewhat longer. But essentially the patient needs to stop taking that drug. And that's unfortunate because we don't really have that many drugs that work well for migraine. And if you happen to fall into the category of someone whose migraines get worse by one of the few available treatments that we have, now you're in a really difficult situation because you know that if you keep taking that drug again, even if after you've come back to normal from stopping the drug, you're always going to be in danger of going back to that place where the headaches got more frequent and they got more intense because of the drug. And that we don't understand really well, and we need to because it's really impacting one of the best drugs that we have.
So many medical problems get worse as we get older, but migraines seem to diminish in frequency and intensity after middle age. What might account for that?
Well, they decrease in frequency and intensity mostly in women. So migraine is a female-biased disorder anyway. It's three times more common in women than it is in men. Before puberty, males and females have about the same prevalence of migraine. At puberty, females skyrocket. Males kind of stay about the same. They go up a little bit, but not much. The peak ages for migraine in women is 20s, 30s, and 40s. At menopause, women start to come back in terms of frequency towards where males are. And by 60, 70, 80 years old, males and females are about the same again. So there's a very, very clear hormonal component to migraine. And that might sound like it makes it an easy thing to figure out, but it hasn't been so easy to figure out what the link between female hormones and migraine is. But there's clearly a link between the two.
What do we – I mean, I know that you are not practicing physicians, but what is the current thinking about sort of empowerment of patients who are dealing with chronic pain, and what can be done to give them a sense that at least they have some control when they're having an episode where they just feel awful?
So I think there are a couple of things. We have made remarkable advances in the last 10 years, I would say, in the molecular biology of pain, finding new targets which are not so much about the transduction of pain, which is what most of our targets have focused on previously, but are about plasticity that occurs in chronic pain. So while the day may not quite be here yet, some drugs are either in late phase 3 clinical trials, nerve growth factor modifying therapies, for instance, are in late phase 3 trials.
Does that mean they're being tested on humans?
Several trials have already been published with remarkable results. So those drugs could soon be coming onto the market. And I think in some instances, like osteoarthritis, maybe even cancer pain, could really revolutionize the way that we treat these diseases, because they appear to have at least some disease-modifying-like effect. That means that they really reduce pain over a very long period of time. But we're discovering more and more mechanisms all the time that appear to be involved in this plasticity. And so a major goal in the field is to discover what those mechanisms are, target them pharmacologically, and target them in such a way that rather than treating pain palliatively, which we almost always do now, that we would treat pain only briefly, and that would cause this plasticity to be reversed. So targeting those molecules that we could permanently reverse a chronic pain state. So I think that that's really important for us to continue to work on with the hope that we will find these better therapeutics for these patients. We keep coming back to education as well, and I think education is really key in this area. And if patients have a better understanding of why pain is chronic after the resolution of, or why pain can be chronic after resolution of injury, that in many cases that can change their outlook. And then a multidisciplinary approach is really key. So, I think that pain patients should understand that physical therapy, psychological counseling, any number of things, and the choice should be up to them and tailored for the individual patient, can be very helpful and is proven time and time again to be an excellent way to deal with chronic pain issues.
Ted Price and Greg Dusor are both associate professors on the neuroscience faculty at the University of Texas at Dallas School of Behavioral and Brain Science. We've been talking this hour about chronic pain. Gentlemen, thank you so much for being with us. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Pleasure.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think, and you can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.